If you've seen any of the reviews for the new Netflix miniseries American Primeval, you'll know what you're in for. Critics have described it as a harrowing watch, unsparingly bleak, blood-soaked, grotesquely, mindlessly violent. And all of this gore took place in the Utah Territory in 1857. That is, the series is based on a true story, or real history. The Utah War, the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Peter Berg directs the series with a screenplay by Mark L. Smith. He wrote the film The Revenant. We talked with Lindsay Hansen Park this week. She was an historical consultant for the series, and she told us Berg didn't want to create a sanitized version of the West. He wanted something like he saw in the 1972 film Jeremiah Johnson, something desolate and harsh.
Peter Berg has been interested in the stories of the frontier for a long time, Mark L. Smith as well, and he talks about first really finding out that there was a creative palette to work with when he realizes the West is not just shootouts and riding on horses and meeting in the public square at high noon. There's this whole story of really complex, really graphic violence. And he talks about a conversation that he's having with Mark L. Smith, the writer of the series, and he's showing sort of this collection of weapons that he has from his obsession with this time period in history. He's got knives and guns, and he has this ice pick, this axe.
And I walked into the room where Mark was sitting and waiting for the meeting, and I just put the ice axe in his lap and I said, "Could you write this as a series?" And he looked at me and smiled, "Yes, I can."
This represents the brutality of the West. What do we do with it?
We wanted to do something that was not traditional Western, that felt as though it had that kind of aggression and the desire to explore a feeling that I got as a kid watching Jeremiah Johnson.
They both come to an interest in Mormon history through frontier history. Mountain Men, Jim Bridger, of course, The Revenant. And if you get into those histories, you can't escape Mormon history. The story goes, as they're doing frontier history, they run into the story of the Mountain Meadows Massacre. They're interested. They contact Church historian Rick Turley, who sends them books, takes them on a tour of the massacre site, and they really start to realize this picture of the violence of the American West in a way that they hadn't heard before, which is through a Mormon lens. I've grown up on Westerns my entire life. John Wayne, Louis Amour books, and it's full of these exciting Western epics and iconic characters, but you hardly ever hear about Mormons. But Mormons were such a huge part of the American West. And so to finally see them starting to be included in the narrative of the West, as they should be, is really exciting. And I think that Peter Berg found that. I mean, there was sort of this mystery of what does violence mean? You know, modern Mormonism, there's a perception of what that is today versus what it was on the frontier. And sometimes they're very different in public memory and in Mormon memory. And so I think that presented a really creative challenge for them.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Okay, so American Primeval is about the violence of the Western frontier, but another challenge for the filmmakers must have been getting the history right, because some say they didn't. They compressed about 15 years of actual history into 2 weeks, but most of the criticism is how the portrayals in the series are one-dimensional and misrepresent Latter-day Saints and their leaders like Brigham Young as violent fanatics. Now, we're not going to adjudicate the particular points of accuracy on the show today, but it did seem worth asking whether any of this really matters. Lindsay Hansen Park talked to us about her work as a consultant for American Primeval, but she also worked on another Netflix series that showed the violence in Mormonism, Under the Banner of Heaven. And she said the two experiences were really different.
I had a lot of say in being able to shape the narrative and the story. I got to do a lot of work on the dialogue, not enough work. I wish we would have pulled out some of the Heavenly Fathers, but I got to be on set. I got to be building it and shaping it. I remember working with Tommy Shalami, this incredible director, and I was like the only person aside from the show creator and the producer that got to tell Tommy, like, cut, cut, you got that wrong. But this was a little bit of a different experience. So when they brought me on, they had already started filming. They just realized that they needed help. I was brought on by the production designer, Renee Reed. She had done Banner with us. And so we had already created the Mountain Meadows Massacre for that show. And for that show, we had done incredible research. And I'm talking months of research. And so Renee and I had already worked on that. And so when they did the massacre for this series, I actually didn't do hardly any work on this massacre because they had already, you know, used my notes. And Peter Berg has a friendship with the top church massacre historian, Rick Turley. Hmm. And they already had who knows how many conversations they toured the massacre site together. So my role this time wasn't to do that. They didn't really use me for story or narrative. I got to help shape some dialogue. My job for this series was really the look and feel. So I helped build the Naboo Legion. That was really cool. We go into like very extensive, specific details about the buttons on their shirt and the flag that the Legion was wearing and what their camp might have looked up based on muster records. And, you know, kind of questions about Brigham Young, how different people would have seen him. Just really, my role depends on how much input the show creators want. And in this particular instance, they already sort of had an idea, a tone, and a pace. And so, you know, I read the script and then I was like, well, you know, Jim Bridger wasn't there at this time. This is wrong. This is wrong. And that didn't matter to them because they had taken like, you know, 20 years of history and truncated it into this like 2-week period. So they weren't really going for a chronology of events. They were going for look, feel, and essence of the West, if that makes sense.
You have said that the creators of American Primeval, Mark Smith, the screenwriter, and Peter Berg, the director, they have crafted, this is how you put it, a brutal fever dream of competing American dreams. What do you mean?
I think if anyone has seen The Revenant, it's very clear that there's a style and a tone and a pace that these show creators want to recreate, right? And so I think that was the thing that came in conflict most with the minutiae of the history, I guess. There was already a vision for how they wanted to portray the West, which I actually agree with that vision. The essence of the West at this time was it was brutal. No one made it out alive. It was just a matter of how horrible your death was. Were you going to die by a scorpion bite or be blood atoned by Hickman and his riding gang? And the show really captures that essence, but it also shows sort of the desperation and the scarcity and the violence of colonization. I think the thing that really enthralled me about the script is the brutality of it. The brutality of the West and the frontier was basically every man for himself. Mm-hmm. And I think that Berg and Smith's vision is really compatible with that idea. Now, how it's portrayed is where we sort of get lost in the details of history.
Well, we'll get to the way it was portrayed here in a second. But to sort of stay on your point for a moment, one of the things Peter Berg has said is that because no one felt as though there was enough oxygen in this space, in the you know, the West, that people were trying to survive. And in a lot of ways, it's about survival. And that's why it became so violent. And this seems like something that you agree with, that this was about naked survival instincts, at least this part of the story of the West.
Yeah. And again, I mean, if I was allowed to consult on story or, you know, narrative at all, I think it would have been very easy to find actual historical examples to infuse into this story to make it compatible with that vision, because I think the historical record is full of them. I think the thing that's frustrating to me in the community is when I hear people say, oh, you're portraying Mormons as violent. The show portrays Brigham Young and the Nauvoo Legion. all right? Not all Mormons. It portrays this group of people. And you don't have to take my word for it. Go look up what the Nauvoo Legion was doing from 47 to 77 during the course of Brigham Young's life in the territory. I've come up with a list of at least 30 massacres, wars, murders that happened that Brigham Young or his Legion had a hand in during this time period. It was a violent time. I mean, prior to the show, Daniel H. Wells, who was running the Nauvoo Legion, he goes in the Mormons with the sanction of the U.S. government go and massacre 100-something Timpanogos, Utes, or Shoshone, depending on where you situate in that history. They were killing people. They were running people out of town. There's another story that I think that Mormons don't realize. There, and this goes back to Nauvoo, and it's called Aunt Peggy. Have you heard about Aunt Peggy?
No.
Okay, so this is going to capture it because I think we see our ancestors as these like pious pilgrims, and some of them were. The large majority of Mormons were just trying to follow God and survive in the American West. But Mormons had this thing that they did with their own people who, if they didn't follow the rules, they enforced them with something that they called a visit from Aunt Peggy. And that was a euphemism that meant Aunt Peggy's privy. Now, we know a privy is an outhouse. So there are stories during the Mormon Reformation of a man that might have offered dinner to a Gentile soldier, to an outside soldier, and Mormon enforcers show up with a visit from Aunt Peggy. They drag him and his wife into the street, and they shove their mouths full of rags dipped in privy water. You know what privy water is, right? They would daub people in privy dirt. They would cover them in feces as a humiliating way to enforce and say, stay in line. You're one of us. Don't feed the Gentiles. Don't work for them. There was a man who clerked. He was a Mormon man who made the mistake of clerking to get money. You know, he needed money to support himself in the 1850s, and he clerks for a soldier. And Mormon men take him out in dead of night and waterboard him in the Jordan River for 24 hours. Like, this is the climate that we're talking about. Mormon enforcers were harsh. The Mormon police acted like a vigilante force for the leader's interests. You know, people think that this is just like an agenda that people are making up to make the church look bad. But let's look at the church's own newspaper. This is a quote from the Deseret News in 1860. They say, quote, "Murder after murder has been committed with impunity within the precincts of Great Salt Lake City till such occurrences do not seemingly attract much attention." That tells you the landscape of what it was like at this time. And of course, were other things happening too that were fine and good? Mormons were, you know, trying to meet for meetings. They were praying together. They were trying to work together. But the Legion and Brigham Young and his Legion, that was a different story. It was a brutal, brutal time in history. Mormons were starving. They were dealing with droughts and locusts and really harsh winters. So they're already stressed. And prior to 1857, you have the Mormon Reformation, where you've got Brigham Young's counselor, Jedediah Grant, teaching blood atonement over the pulpit, which is this idea that some sins cannot be paid for by Jesus Christ, so you have to shed your own blood through the slitting of your throat. And Mormons today will say that's metaphorical, but not all Mormons back then saw it as metaphorical. And we have instances of people using it. Again, it's just this, I think people just don't understand what it was like to survive in the 1850s in Utah Territory.
So you hear this from filmmakers all the time, the who are trying to do period pieces, pieces that involve actual history. Something along the line of what Ridley Scott, the director, said, that he's a filmmaker, not an anthropologist. And Peter Berg, the director of American Primeval, said something kind of like that. He said, "We never said we were making a documentary." Now, is that a cop-out in some way to just say, look, I can do whatever I want. We can take whatever kind of creative license with the basics of the story. Like, and do they get it right, the creators, or right enough, maybe, put it that way?
I think it depends on what you're after. Huh. And this is what I've had to learn, too, because knowing the history, I've been reading the history of Mormonism since I was a little girl almost every day, right? I come from a family of storytellers and pioneer storytellers. That is a different narrative and a different agenda. The thing that I wish our community understood is they are distinct crafts. Filmmaking is a craft and history is a craft. And they each have rules and they have structures and they have values that they prioritize. And there's a lot of compatibility with both crafts, but there are some differences. Both are after truth. They just pursue it in different ways. Now, filmmaking, if you're a good storyteller, you're after the truth of the human spirit, the essence of the human soul, the sort of Joseph Campbell, Jungian archetypes of who you are. History is different. It's about getting the chronology as accurate as possible based on the documentary evidence. And so, yeah, when I'm in this history all the time, part of me is like, there's so many good stories to pull from. We could still accomplish the goals of the narrative if you let us in. And I think that it speaks to the need to have more control with consultants who understand this stuff, who are in it every day, to allow them to help shape it. Because I do believe that when that happens, when you bring Mormons in, Latter-day Saints into their own stories, they can offer perspectives that outsiders don't have. Now, that said, I was talking to a friend, Brian Cogman. He's the writer, main writer of Game of Thrones. We're working on a project together. And he reminded me, he was like, you know, dramatists have been playing with historical narratives since Shakespeare. You know, we don't look at Shakespeare's plays about the monarchy and be like, oh my gosh, what a dangerous distortion of the history. Shakespeare was after the lessons that you can learn from, you know, the archetypes of power. And I think that that's the conflict here, is there's a misunderstanding of the distinct crafts and their goals and their aim. And would I like to see more confluence and compatibility? Yes, because I actually think that Mormon history, as it stands on the record, is actually far more interesting than anything that I could ever imagine, that anyone could imagine. Such a richness to pull from that I hope that more creators start, you know, using more Mormon voices and Mormon historians in a way that is reflective of the stories that we know. And I don't mean like sanitizing it, right? Because we come from a very, when we talk about misrepresentation on film or in narrative, like our community, the LDS community is not great at that. We don't have a good track record at that either. But I do think that there's so much creative potential in these stories. And to me, it's exciting that Mormons are starting to become a part of the narrative of the West, because they absolutely were.
But it does matter to some degree, right? I mean, one of the things you have said is that when you get it really wrong, that you can collapse a narrative, that you can erase nuance. So they have to at least hew to some kind of reality. And here's the other question, though, while you're thinking of that. It may not matter to a Netflix audience in general, but it seems to matter to Latter-day Saints if they're fudging the facts. Now, what do you say to that?
Well, it's tricky, because I think most of the world does not even know what the massacre is.
Yeah.
Most of the world doesn't even know where Utah is on a map, right? So when you're a creator, you're starting with that. But Mormons, we are a people that we write in our journals and we document our genealogy, and it is very important to us. We recreate our own history in treks. You know, we dress up in the costumes. That is very important to us. But I don't look to our community as a healthy example of representation. And I think that that is the incompatibility here. Mormons are not practiced at seeing themselves from outsiders. And too often we fall into two very predictable patterns, blame and persecution. And this is an old narrative, and there's a reason why we go into that pattern. And I think Mormons need the history and are used to looking at the history to either prove the church true, faith promoting, or the history needs to be so true that it can prove it wrong and take people out of the church. And that's kind of the waters of Mormon history, right? There's this purity that we expect because the stakes are so high for our community. But the rest of the world isn't interested in that. And I don't think Mark Smith or Peter Burke are interested in, nor should they be interested in, exonerating our character. I do think this is an opportunity for Mormons to look at why we're always represented, why Brigham Young is represented as a villain in history. Because I think there's a pretty big documentary history that shows that that's the case. We're not used to seeing him as the villain, but maybe we should be a little bit more imaginative and look at different lenses, because the rest of the world does. And why is that? Is it because we're being persecuted and misrepresented, or is there something else going on?
What do you think? I'm not sure if you've had conversations with the creators about this, but I wonder what you think they make of the discussion we're having now, or others have been having in the Intermountain West in particular, about American primeval, just the way it portrays Latter-day Saints and the Mormon story. Like, what do they think about all the commotion, if they think about it at all? I mean, their series is doing really well on Netflix. So whether they consider those questions all that much, do they make much of it, do you think?
I mean, I can't speak to individuals because I haven't spoken to them about reactions. I will say that I know a lot of people in the industry now, and I think people think that Mormons are weird, you know? And this is kind of what I tell my community, like, okay, you're upset because you think this is a collapsed cardboard, you know, caricature of Mormon history. Again, look up the Utah Boer. It's a lot messier than you remember that it is. But what we're dealing with is Mormons are mad that this show shows, you know, Brigham Young and the Legion as angry, defensive, violent, territorial, taking themselves too seriously. And then a lot of Latter-day Saints react with anger, defensiveness, territorialism, and taking themselves too seriously. It's like, guys, don't reinforce that. This is television. Let's lighten up a little bit. I mean, you know, the idea that misrepresentation can harm people is absolutely a thing. But also there's an onus on our community here that if we want to be taken seriously, we are a mainstream religion going into the global world. We're growing up, you know, and growing up takes some maturity. And let's look at other faiths who are a lot more mature than ours, like the Catholic Church. Every time a priest is shown on TV, you don't see a huge uproar about the accuracy of how that portrayal is depicted. And I think that that's kind of my hope for our community is if you want to see more Mormon stories and more accurate representation, we got to show people that we can be mature enough to discuss it and understand the limitations of filmmaking, the limitations of history, the compatibilities and the conflicts. I don't think we're there yet, but I will say I think that this show's reaction is still a lot better than it was with Under the Banner of Heaven. I am seeing a maturation happening. And rather than saying, oh, that's not fair, you're painting us all as violent, it's like, no, we're talking about an iconic character. But I think when you're defensive about his portrayal, for example, and you're saying it's misrepresentation, then what you're doing is you're making a moral argument for him. And I'm curious what that moral argument is. If you're saying that he's misrepresented, then tell me how you think he should morally be represented. And when I am doing this for a show, you sort of have to take all these examples from the history and sort of, if you're making a moral judgment for a depiction, are we going to show an iconic character of the West, which Brigham Young was? He's an icon. How do we portray that icon? Is he violent? Is he not? Is he good? Is he bad? Is he more nuanced? You sort of have to weigh his virtues and his vices on sort of this like scale of Mott's. And I have to tell my community, I think the thing that is kind of strange for me is there's this big outcry from Latter-day Saints saying, Brigham Young, you know, Mormons are being misrepresented. We're not like that. We're not violent. Nauvoo Legion was. And if we're going to put all the horrible things that Brigham Young said about African Americans and women and Native peoples and frankly anyone he didn't like, and couple that with the history of the Legion's violence, with their massacres and their murders and their cover-ups, where do the scales tip? And if yours, weighing both of those things, has him as a more moral man, you and I do have a disagreement on how this icon should be portrayed, because I think the history defends Brigham Young as kind of a gangster of the West. That's who I think he was.
Lindsay Hanson Park, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lindsay Hansen Park. She's a writer and researcher, the executive director of the Mormon journal Sunstone, also a history and cultural advisor to the production of the Netflix miniseries American Primeval. Take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the Netflix miniseries American Primeval. It's a Western, sort of. It's set in the Utah Territory in 1857, and the series creators explore how violence, really savage violence, helped shape U.S. history. And Latter-day Saints are among the violent ones. So we've been talking about the portrayal of Mormonism in films and television. Patrick Mason joined us this week. He's a scholar of religion and history at Utah State University. And he said he figured he knew why Latter-day Saints have always been subjects for storytellers.
I think there's probably a few different reasons for this. One is the origin story is both familiar and fantastic. It's American. It's a farm boy. There's a book of scripture. There's a church. It's kind of somehow related to Christianity, so that there's familiar elements of it, but it's also so unfamiliar with angels and gold plates and prophets and those kinds of things. And
fair to say strange?
For a lot of people, sure. Yeah, looking in from the outside. Those aren't normal stories of normal everyday occurrences. Yeah. So I think that's part of it. There's always been a kind of mysterious quality to Mormonism, partly because Mormons have been so successful at building strong and sometimes insular communities. And then you magnify that by there are certain elements of Mormonism that are just literally off limits to the public gaze, especially temple rituals and some things like that. Then you add polygamy, which of course is the most famous thing about Mormonism and its history. There's a luridness to it. I think you combine all of that and Mormonism has always been something to gaze upon as something that is both close enough to be somewhat recognizable, but distant enough to be strange and exotic.
Do you think that Latter-day Saints, again, speaking as, let's say, someone who's perceiving this from the outside, that they're seen as easy targets to, you know, make fun of or parody or even distort their story because they're perceived as maybe lacking a kind of sophistication or are a group of people who are kind of credulous because they believe this fantastical story? And so they're an easy target to storytellers or even elites. Is there some of that in here for you?
Yeah, I think at a certain level, Latter-day Saints can be and can present as an easy target, if we want to call it that, for a couple of different reasons. One is that especially when you put it in a broader national, let alone global context, there aren't that many of them. So it doesn't hurt you if you're making some kind of media product or, you know, whether it be a book, a movie, a TV show or something like that. And if you offend all the Mormons, you're not losing that much market share. But maybe there's also one other factor is that Latter-day Saints have spent their entire history seeking out converts but have not always been very good at seeking out friends. And sometimes it's precisely in the convert seeking that they've alienated other people and have not had friends and allies to speak up for them.
One of the things you've also said is that the reason Latter-day Saints are subject to critiques or parody in TV series and in films is that they have power, which might surprise some, but say a little bit more about that. Active Latter-day Saints are like 1% or less in the country, but Mormons have power. Explain what you mean.
This is where there is a paradox. On one hand, yeah, Latter-day Saints are quite small in terms of percentage of the population, but there are few religious organizations or institutions that have been as successful as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in recent decades, especially financially and there's plenty of stories. This is not a secret at this point in terms of the hundreds of billions of dollars of assets that the church controls.
Yeah.
And the fact is that at least regionally, and in some cases nationally, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints does punch above its weight because of the resources that it controls, because of even our federal system of representation. It means there's always, even though Latter-day Saints are only 1% of the population, there's usually a handful of Latter-day Saint senators and congresspeople. The Latter-day Saints are well represented in the military and in the upper echelons of the business community and so forth. Latter-day Saints have been phenomenally successful over the past 100 years in assimilating in many of these key areas of American society. So they're overrepresented. It's not like they're the Amish who are just like out farming on their own and so forth. There's a sense that this very small group that we don't understand very well, they are in the halls of power. And we're not sure if we like that. Nobody feels sorry for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, given all that we know about its resources.
So you don't know much about the actual content or storylines for American Primeval. So I won't ask you to give details about that. And it wouldn't be fair to ask you to compare it to other films or series that have featured Latter-day Saints. But do you have a sense anyway of whether American Primeval falls in line with, like, Under the Banner of Heaven, for you anyway? I mean, you said that show, Under the Banner of Heaven, was driven by this agenda or thesis that it was openly hostile to religion. As far as you can tell, is American Primeval that?
Yeah, it's interesting to me, as I've read the reports and even the interviews with the creators of American Primeval, they quite admirably, I think, took great care to bring in historical and cultural consultants to help them understand the indigenous peoples that they were presenting in their stories. They don't seem to have had the same level of concern on the Latter-day Saint side. I'm not saying they had no concern at all. They did have historical consultants, but not at the same level, by their own admission.
Yeah.
So those are choices that the creators make in terms of which stories do we want to tell with great fidelity, with care and concern for the living people in the 21st century who still identify with those characters and those communities that are being represented on screen, versus maybe some of the characters and communities we don't think so much about and the way that they identify with these characters.
What do you see on Netflix when you spin through that has to do with religion in this country, fiction and nonfiction? You once said that there's almost a genre on Netflix going after religion. Are you still seeing that? And just what do you make generally of the portrayals of people of faith, whether it's a period piece or whether it's a modern documentary or anything like that?
I think it's fair to say that there's a range of things. When I look at Netflix or other streaming services in terms of how they approach religion and religiosity, religious characters, what I see oftentimes, there's a one particular subgenre of the heroic exit from the oppressive religion.
Huh.
Those are real and powerful stories. Those are not made up, and I don't think they're necessarily hit pieces. But it is a genre, and I think it tells us something about the heroes that we choose. So I think that's one genre. One is the kind of expose genre. Like, here's a community that you don't know anything about, and they're mysterious and a bit strange, and they don't track with what we assume your values are, dear viewer. And so we're going to go deep inside this community and tell you all about it. And then I think some of it is pretty straightforward, just historical telling. It's kind of a documentary. Let me tell you about the history and where these things come from. And I think any of these genres can be done well. Any of these genres can be done, I think, less well or less responsibly. But there are we just continue to see kind of patterns or tropes in terms of the way that religion is oftentimes presented in the mass media.
Are Mormons getting a fair shake in that sense?
I think it's a mix.
You think it's a mix?
I do. I see, for instance, a movie like Heretic, and I see it as, first of all, genuine attention to some of the inside details of the culture and the way people dress and talk and think. I also think, for instance, in that movie, my reading of it is that religion wins in the end. And that the message is that this, and it's not unique to Latter-day Saints, but they are kind of a case study there, that a message of care and compassion, even if you can't fully rationalize it or reason it out, that that's preferable. So I think that, I think something like Murder Among the Mormons, I thought was an excellent documentary, and showing just the complexity of the Mark Hoffman case and everything that was going on and the church's response to it. Even some of these shows like The Secret Lives of Mormon Housewives, one of the things it shows is complexity within a community. I mean, one way that you can dismiss a community is just by saying they're entirely homogenous. They're all clones of one another. They don't think independently. They just do what their leaders say. Well, that's clearly not going on in The Secret Lives of Mormon Housewives. And so somebody watches that. Now, are those women representative of Mormons or Mormonism? No. But in some ways, that's the point. It's, there is no one representative way of being Mormon. There is lots of ways of being and doing Mormon. So that, even in its own way, I think breaks down some of these kinds of stereotypes. So I think it's a mixed bag.
Huh. You know, we talked with Lindsay Hansen Park, and one of the things she said is that she is seeing among Latter-day Saints more of what she described as a kind of maturity about seeing these portrayals in the media, that they're not so thin-skinned, maybe. She said that if the LDS community wants to be taken seriously, it's important to be a little more mature about how the faith is portrayed on film and TV. Like, there are limitations of filmmaking. Like, they have to distort the details a little bit to make it a little bit more dramatic. And she thinks that that's important for her, she said, fellow Mormons to sort of get with it. And she's seeing a little bit more of that. I wonder, are you seeing that as well?
I think so. I think part of that maturity actually started, or the first time I really saw it, was with the response to the Book of Mormon musical. Mm. The church's response, I thought, was quite savvy and mature, rather than saying, oh, this is a yet another tale of religious persecution and woe is us, and we're going to boycott this thing. You know, they took out ads and said, hey, the book is better, or have you read the book? It's always better. I think that shows a kind of maturity. I think there is a recognition from people when they see some of these series, okay, I recognize that a movie or a TV show, I don't need it to be 100% right. I just need it not to be wrong about the most important things.
Patrick Mason, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Doug.
Patrick Mason, he's a professor of religious studies and history at Utah State University. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been discussing what people around here are saying about American Primeval. It's the new and very popular miniseries on Netflix set in the Utah Territory in 1857. We reached out to the film scholar Andrew Nelson to talk to us. He told us these portrayals of Latter-day Saints and Mormonism in general have been around almost since the beginning of film.
Well, Mormons were portrayed infrequently, which really shouldn't surprise us given how few Mormons there are. But when they were portrayed, they tended to be depicted in a particular way, really as a particular character. And that character was the villainous polygamist. So you would often in these films have young women. Sometimes they would be immigrants. Oftentimes they would be on vacation, who would be seduced by a handsome, dark stranger, and then ultimately abducted by this character who is revealed to be the polygamist. This is a character that cinema inherits from literature. You know, there are stories by some of the major authors of the late 19th and early 20th centuries that include this villain, Arthur Conan Doyle, Zane Grey, Robert Louis Stevenson, Jack London. I mean, this character, you know, appears in their novels. This is the character who You know, Sherlock Holmes combats at some point, but the victim, you know, as in the title of the film, A Victim of the Mormons, is always, you know, a young, impressionable, somewhat naive woman who is abducted into, you know, essentially a life of sexual slavery.
So the films then weren't really anything like the films that are portraying Mormon culture today. They weren't about violence in early Mormonism and frontier Mormonism. They weren't about corruption or chicanery by, you know, leaders like Joseph Smith or the kind of cult-like impression of this high-demand faith. They were a different thing, it sounds like.
Well, they were in some ways like some of the films we get today. You know, you think about some of the films inspired by Warren Jeffs. There's a number of documentaries about him and also a fairly terrible TV movie. And, you know, in that sense, in those films, the rapist, polygamist villain is, you know, who's heading a cult is still very much with us. But, you know, that is, I suppose, still today a minor character in the pantheon of Mormon iconography.
So there's not, I like how you put this to us. You said there's not really a unified theory of Mormon representation out there.
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of very good writing about the representation of Mormons in popular culture. And, you know, a number of scholars have made the case that the Mormon is actually somewhat flexible, that it's, you know, Mormonism, in their view, always speaks to something about sex, always something about sex. But a Mormon can be, you know, on the one hand, can represent like sexual chastity. But on the other hand, it can mean like a very, you know, predatory sexual violence. And then we get, you know, everything in between, bizarre, libidinous, you know, you name it. So the archetype is actually quite flexible in its manifestations, but it usually takes us back to some kind of anxiety or maybe sort of an attraction and repulsion about sex, usually in the form of polygamy.
One thing you pointed out is that there were positive portrayals of Latter-day Saints. I mean, and not made by you know, Mormon filmmakers. I mean, John Ford wasn't a Mormon, and he had a decent portrayal of Latter-day Saints.
Absolutely. I mean, there are a number of examples in Hollywood history. Again, you know, not a lot of them.
Yeah.
Which is to be expected. But, you know, Joseph Smith gets the epic Hollywood treatment in 1940, you know, and that film is so well received in Utah that, you know, everyone's given the day off work and school and it's Joseph Smith Day. John Ford's Wagon Master is a great example, which, you know, is a little cagey when it comes to identifying the actual religion of the pioneers. But it is a very positive portrayal where the film's two heroes, who are kind of two, you know, ne'er-do-well drifter cowboys, you know, end up better people through their association with LDS folk.
Okay, so let's step away from the sort of portrayal of Mormons here for a minute. Does historical accuracy matter much at all? And here's the caveat, for an audience. Does it matter for an audience?
You know, I certainly know lots of people who, you know, in my what is really my wheelhouse, mm-hmm. the Western, yeah. care a great deal about historical accuracy. And, you know, I get emails from these people sometimes who can opine about the saddles and the blankets and the firearms and the hats and so on. You know, so sort of the minutiae of history up to, you know, large-scale criticisms about how and why particular things happened, usually telling us that, you know, it wasn't like that in real life. But I don't think that the, you know, the average moviegoer cares that much about historical accuracy. What matters, and this is an important thing to keep in mind with film or maybe any art, isn't so much you know, historical accuracy as verisimilitude, you know, the appearance of being real or true. And of course, what is going to strike a viewer as a believable depiction of the past will change over time. And then, of course, you know, our understanding of the past also is constantly changing. New research is conducted. We find new evidence. New arguments supplant old ones. And, you know, films need to speak to the audiences of their day.
I think this has come up in the conversations we've been having about this, that there is a difference between just pure history and just telling a story. And something you said art is not history. It's an interpretation of history. Say more.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, no, we often confuse that. I mean, we often look to art to tell us about the past. And, you know, why do we do that? Because it's often more entertaining and digestible. Mm. You know, this isn't a new phenomenon. You know, the Iliad, for example, is a story we tell ourselves about the Trojan War. Is it history? I mean, it's debatable how much history is actually in, you know, those ancient epic poems. But we've been doing this for a long time. And there's maybe a sense that, you know, by divorcing events to a certain degree from history, we can maybe arrive at something more like truth. I think art can lead us to truth, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's the same thing as history.
You know, but I can hear a very devout, active Latter-day Saint responding to this conversation saying, look, guys, this sounds really good in the abstract, but the way this is in, let's take, of course, American Primeval, the way Brigham Young, say, is portrayed is not fair to the real lives lived by those characters. He wasn't that bloodthirsty character, or the Nauvoo Legion, they weren't these incredibly violent people. They, you know, they went home and loved their families and they went to church and all of those things. So in that sense, it's not fair. Like, how do you respond to that?
I understand and sympathize with that frustration. You know, it's difficult to see, you know, your beliefs criticized or mocked. And it's also, you know, challenging to see, you know, history portrayed in ways that you know are wrong. And I mean, I have this experience, you know, not to that degree, but, you know, oftentimes where I'll hear someone say something about, you know, Western movies or Western history or American cinema that I know is just wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's wrong in ways that are bad because they, you know, reinforce stereotypes or kind of rote narratives that we've told each other over the years. So I have a little bit of insight into that frustration. But what I would say, and I have said to people of faith, is that this is fair game, because what does it say about your faith if it can't withstand scrutiny or mockery? And in terms of any Christian faith, we need to remember that Jesus said this would happen. This is what we signed up for.
What are you seeing in the portrayals of Mormons today? Because it seems like it's all over the map. Like, there's the villainous polygamist is, maybe it's sort of still there, but it seems quite different now. Or am I off on that?
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think that in the 21st century, we have seen a, you know, significant shift. So is the villainous polygamist is still with us, and, you know, the Mormon supporting characters are probably still with us, but Mormons are often the main character, if not the hero. I don't know if it's too much to trace a lot of this back to one episode of South Park, but, you know, you have a fairly, I think, even-handed episode about Mormonism in that particular show, you know, that comes to the ultimate conclusion that at the end of the day, if you love your family and are nice to each other, who are you to criticize people, right, if you aren't espousing those values? Like that, that's what that episode is about. That gives us the Book of Mormon. You know, we had the HBO series Big Love, again, fascination with polygamy, same with the reality television show Sister Wives. You know, it's probably the case now that you're actually more likely to see a Mormon on your television than you are to see one at the front door, which is a big change from, let's say, the 20th century. So, I you know, I think we're moving to something, you know, different and maybe a little more nuanced. And, you know, a good recent example, which, you know, stirred some controversy, is the film Heretic, where the, you know, the two protagonists are young missionaries. I wouldn't want to give too much away, but, you know, that's a film where the person of faith undergoes a very serious trial and emerges in a way that, you know, at least from some perspectives, reaffirms the importance of faith. That is a long way from a victim of the Mormons. That's progress.
Andrew Nelson, thank you very much.
My pleasure, as always.
That's Andrew Nelson. He's a film scholar and the chief curator at Western Spirit, Scottsdale's Museum of the West. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. on Instagram at Radio West, and you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Katrina Cano. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.